the odds of a young girl being discovered by an industry insider while singing to herself pumping gas? 1 in 300 million. The odds of the daughter of a clergyman from Severn, Maryland spending 11 weeks at number one on the U.S. singles charts? 1 in 19 million. The odds of going on to win 6 Grammy Awards? 1 in 1.4 million. The odds of selling over 40 million records? 1 in 800,000. The odds of this musician and performer having a child diagnosed with autism? 1 in 110. I'm Toni Braxton, and I encourage you to learn the signs of autism at autismspeaks.org. Early diagnosis can make a lifetime of difference. Autism Speaks. It's time to listen. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council.
Good morning, and welcome to Saturday Mornings with Joy Cheese. I'm your host, Joy Cheese. I want to thank you all for listening this morning. April is Autism Awareness Month. That's why I'm doing the show today. In researching for the show, I've learned an immense amount about autism, and I want to share that information with others because I think there are a lot of confusion around what it is and who has it and why do they have it and what can we do to help people who have autism. And that's why I have the show today. I have some great guests on the line. Right now I have Dr. Marianne Barton. She's a licensed clinical psychologist, and she's currently associate clinical professor and director of the Psychological Services Clinic at the University of Connecticut. Dr. Barton is one of the authors of MCHAT, which is the Modified Checklist for Autism in Toddlers, which is a widely used screening tool for the detection of autism spectrum disorders in children aged 16 to 30 months. Good morning, Dr. Barton.
Good morning.
I also have on the line Camille Proctor. She is the founder of the Color of Autism Foundation, and she is a mother of an autistic son. And after witnessing the great divide in the level of care for African-American families affected by ASD, that's how she started the organization. Good morning, Camille.
Good morning to you.
Also on the line is Terry Aranga. I hope I'm pronouncing your name correctly.
Yes, that's fine. Thank you.
Okay, good. She's the director of Autism One. She's also the editor of the U.S. and Canadian edition of the Autism File magazine and a program host on the Voice of America Health and Wellness channel. Terry received the National Autism Association's Believe Award for 2008. Good morning, Terry.
Good morning, Joy. Thank you.
You're welcome. And also, Aisha China is on the line. I was referred to her through Terry, and she has Asperger's, and today she's going to talk to us about how art has helped her with her Asperger's. Good morning, Aisha.
Good morning.
Thank you all so much for joining me. I want to read something I just had in the New York Times just March 27th, so this just past week. A nominee to Disability Council is a lightning rod for dispute on the views of autism. This is about Mr. Nay Aman. He is the founder of the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network, and he's at the forefront of a growing movement that describes autism as a form of neurodiversity that should be embraced and accommodated, just as a physical disability has led to the construction of ramps and stalls and public restrooms for people with disabilities. Autism, he and others say, is part of the identity. So this is a really hot topic about how people with autism should be viewed and treated and supported. So we're going to be talking about that in today's show. I want to start off with Dr. Barton. She's a clinical psychologist. And let's talk about what is autism and the variety of, because it's called spectrum, you know.
Yeah.
So talk to us about what it is, I guess, from we're hopefully the Dr. Wheeler, who's a neurologist, will call and who can talk a little bit about the physical and neurological aspects. But from your perspective as a clinical psychologist, talk to us about autism spectrum disorders.
Well, autism is a neurodevelopmental disorder. There's no question about that. There's a significant genetic contribution to autism. We diagnose it, however, entirely on the basis of behavioral manifestations. So we are concerned about delays in reciprocal social interaction, the inability to engage in comfortable interaction with other people who are important in a child's world. We look for atypical or marked delays in communication development, both verbal and nonverbal forms of communication. And we look for the things that I think people think of most often, which are the repetitive, atypical behaviors or highly restricted interests. But in fact, We often do not observe those behaviors in very young children when we want to make an early diagnosis of an autistic spectrum disorder. There's enormous variability in children's presentation. And, you know, you notice we did not talk about cognitive deficits in this population. Some children with autism have cognitive deficits and have significant impairments. Other children have no cognitive or language deficits and would still be considered to have an autistic spectrum disorder.
Now, according to the CDC, parents should be getting their kids screened, developmental screenings at 9, 18, and 24 months.
Well,
what do you think about that?
I think our screening tools at 9 months are not quite reliable. If we have concerns at 9 months, we certainly want to monitor that child very carefully, but I think we have to remember that development in the early years is highly variable. However, I think the American Academy of Pediatrics is recommending that we screen children at the 18-month checkup and again at the 24-month checkup for autistic spectrum disorders. We can reliably pick up autism by 18 months, and we understand that there is a group of children who look typical at 18 months and who will experience a regression before 24 months, which is why we want to screen them twice at that age.
So now let's talk about the issue. I'm not sure if you can speak to this. I was reading about the amygdala and how it's growing too fast or larger in people with autism. Are you familiar with that issue?
Yeah, I think you're talking about the amygdala. I'm not entirely certain that we have good data that it is the amygdala that is growing too fast. That's a portion of the brain that is responsible for emotional experience, emotional regulation. What we know, in fact, is that children with autistic spectrum disorders experience a significant acceleration in head growth in the very early years. And we think that has to do, maybe, and this is very much theoretical, with the development of all kinds of connections in the brain. But rather than those connections being focused as they are in more typically developing kids, they're more diffuse and they kind of go off in a lot of different areas and are therefore less useful to the child in terms of being able to interact with their environment and learn from that experience. But this is very much, we have some neurobiologic studies in support of this model and others who do not yet support it. So this is very much at the level of speculation right now.
Now, the National Institute for Neurological Disorders and Strokes mentions about the issue of abnormal levels of serotonin or other neurotransmitters in the brain. What do you think about that, Dr. Barton?
Well, I don't think that we have consistent data about that, and we certainly don't have data about that in the very youngest kids. And so I think we then get into this problem of, you know, if you have an autistic spectrum disorder, that is going to completely alter the way in which you interact with your world. And we don't know what could be the effects of those different kinds of experiences. So I think our understanding of what is happening in the brains of young children with autism is just beginning to emerge. And unfortunately, the data that we have is highly contradictory, which probably has to do with the way we define the disorder.
Right. Now, let me bring in some other people into the call right now. Camille, you founded your Color of Autism organization because your son has autism. What were some of the signs, or how did you know? When was he diagnosed? At what age?
Well, he was officially diagnosed after he was about two. However, I saw signs pretty early on. He wasn't hitting his milestones. He made a lot of sounds as a baby. I mean, he babbled a lot. But the babble never changed into words. He didn't point. He didn't wave back. His communication with you was, like, if you waved at him, he'd smile. That's what he thought acknowledging you was. That was his hello.
Mm-hmm.
And it was difficult for me as a parent because people put a label on what autism looks like. And because my son is very engaging and he makes a lot of eye contact and he loves women, people just assume, you know, people just assume that he was, you know, just developmentally delayed because, you know, he was always trying to hug you, kiss you, and, you know, take you away if you were a woman.
Mm-hmm.
So it was hard. It was really hard. I was like one of those parents who had to fight for a diagnosis. So.
Well, that's a good point. You just brought up the issue of the variability, and I'm sure Dr. Barton mentioned that, and that people with autism suffer from different things and at different levels of severity. So audio, visual, tactile. Terry, why did you start your organization, Autism One?
The name of the organization is Autism One. Is that your question?
No, I was talking about how did you start your organization and why did you start your organization? What was the goal?
I'm sorry.
There was
a flip in the connection. The goal of Autism One is to bring accurate and timely information that will aid families in helping their children who have autism.
So what are some of the resources that you have? Because people with autism, in the movie I was watching last night, again, The Mother's Courage, I think it's a great movie. You should check it out. It's on HBO. The issue of access to care is severe. I mean, if people don't have a lot of money, they don't have health insurance, or even people with health insurance, and they're going to doctors who are not familiar with autism or what to look for, I mean, what can you offer them at Autism One?
Well, first of all, I'd like to agree with you, Joy, that some segments of the population don't have as good access to progressive health care, and that can be detrimental to gaining really good treatment for their children who have autism. The most important thing for families listening is to know that there is hope and that autism is treatable and that children have recovered from autism. At our conference, for example, we bring in, this year there will be over 150 speakers, and we bring in the experts who really are defining the problem correctly. And in order to affect a solution, you really need to define the problem correctly.
Mm-hmm. I want to bring Aisha into this call. Aisha China, thank you so much for calling in this morning. Terry Aranga connected me with Aisha. I want you to tell us about your story and living with Asperger's and how art has helped you with your Asperger's.
Well, pretty much as a child, I never really, fit in with other students. Like, I always was to myself. A lot of kids would, think I was a bit strange because a lot of times in the classroom I always wanted to play by myself, draw by myself, do assignments by myself. I was pretty much a really shy kid growing up, but as time went by, I realized that art has always been something that I had a lot of interest in, like, in situations where, where I would get depressed or unhappy, art was very therapeutic for me even at a young age. And a lot of students saw that I was, pretty advanced with my art skills compared to them. Like, they were always curious about how was I able to draw such things when I was, some of the classmates were even older than me and I could draw, twice as better as them.
Mm-hmm.
So, as time went by growing up, I went to middle school, and I became more mature, but I still had that drive for artwork. It was just something I was always interested in. Not just artwork, but writing as well. They pretty much go together. And when it came to artwork, it seemed to have helped me academically as well. So
now, where did you go to? Where did you? You went to Moore. Did you go to Moore? I was told, I believe.
Yes, I've been going there. I believe since I was in elementary school, I've won scholarships to go to the school because of my artwork and how well I was doing in class. So I pretty much got to go there for free.
Mm-hmm.
And I also was accepted to go to Morris College of Art.
That's great. Now, what do you think about Mr. Naaman? He's the founder of Autistic Self-Advocacy Network, and he feels that autism is a form of neurodiversity that should be embraced and accommodated. What do you think that people who don't have autism how should we interact with someone who has Asperger's, or how do you want us to treat you as a society, as an individual?
What I really don't appreciate is when some people think of, autism and think, think of it as just a disability. I really think everyone should be treated equally because everyone's special in their own unique way, but that doesn't mean you shouldn't treat them equally. And I really found it hard for a lot of students that had disabilities, you know, like autism, Asperger's, growing up in school, and they never fit in with other classmates because they wouldn't treat them the same as they treat, like, classmates that didn't have autism.
Mm-hmm,
and I just
mm-hmm.
find that unfair because when they grow up in the world and they want to be someone, they don't really be anyone because of how much they were discouraged growing up in school.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
That did not stop me because I grew up having a wonderful mother, Elizabeth China, and I'm grateful for her. And I also have to thank Terry for recommending me for Autism One. I really appreciate that because I just want to show people out there in the world that even someone with autism could be someone in life.
Yes. Dr. Barton, I want to bring you back into the conversation. Aisha brought up the issue of being separate from the other students and losing hope. Now, the issue of depression, how can someone, you know, how can parents, because parents are affected by this too. I mean, the child may be the one actually suffering with autism, but as a psychologist, when you deal with parents, what can you tell the parents? What kind of hope can you give parents to deal with the issue of depression with themselves because of what's going on with their child?
You know, I think there's a real process to dealing with the diagnosis of an autistic spectrum disorder and then really thinking through the process of how to help this child become the most fully functional person that they can be. And of course, there's enormous variation in that process. I think it's often hard to get the diagnosis. Parents often feel very, very sad, sometimes depressed. And I think the thing that is most helpful to them at that stage and at many stages in this process is support from other parents who have been on this journey. I mean, certainly they need support from professionals as well, but many of our parents really value support groups that are available in the community. I think to the extent that parents feel that they can be helpful to their children and affect their progress, they feel much better. And that gets to the issue of the availability of resources. And, you know, resources are not evenly distributed.
Definitely. I agree with you, and that's a very important issue. I want to talk about the Individuals with Disability Education Act. And many parents may not realize that that was originally enacted in 1975, but it was to ensure that children with disabilities have the opportunity to receive free, I want to say that again, free appropriate public education just like other children.
Mm-hmm.
Camille, in your experience with your son, does he go to public school? What type of schooling does he go to now?
Well, now he's in the public school system. At one point he was... It was rough for me because I needed daycare, and there aren't many inclusive daycares.
Mm-hmm.
What is the cost difference? What is the cost difference from, say, you know, someone who has a child who doesn't have autism? You know, they're paying, you know, $600 a month, but your child has autism, so you need special care. Do you mind sharing how much people are telling you would have to pay for the services?
Oh, sure. Let's see. Well, first of all, like I said, there's not enough inclusive daycares. So what they want to do typically is have you get a facilitator. And I'm sorry for the echo. A facilitator would be at a cost of $13 an hour, and effectively that person follows your child around throughout the day and keeps them on task.
Wow, $13 an hour. I mean, that is an enormous amount of money.
Of the fee for the school, which would be somewhere around $260 a week, and then you have to equate the facilitator at $13 an hour, 6 hours a day.
Mm. So it's a severe economic strain on families who, especially at this time in our economy in the United States, you know, are suffering. Dr. Barton, let's talk about some solutions here for people who have autism in terms of applied behavioral analysis. Tell the audience what that is.
Applied behavioral analysis is a strategy based on behavioral principles that does a number of things. It breaks down complicated behaviors into smaller component tasks, which makes them much easier to teach. We teach children these these skills in a very focused and organized way. We reward them when they are successful. Increasingly, we want to take behavioral intervention out of an isolated setting and do it in the natural environment as much as we possibly can. We want to do it in an inclusionary classroom. We want to do it with typical peers as much as we can. We can't always do that, but that certainly is our goal. And, you know, I think the data suggests that this is a highly effective intervention for children with autism, and that some proportion, not all, but some proportion of children who get intensive early intervention do have the potential to have what we call an optimal outcome, to lose.
Now, when you say early intervention, how early? Because you're saying you can't screen until 18 or 24 months. Are you saying, boom, as soon as they got diagnosed at 24 months,
yes, we
then
like
that's when they need to start?
We can screen at 18 months. We want to screen again so we don't miss kids, but many children we can pick up at 18 months and we can start effective intervention that early if there is the opportunity for early intervention programs.
Joy.
Now what? Yes, go ahead.
Terry? I'm sorry.
I just wanted to
let parents know so that they could feel empowered and not discouraged that even if your child is an older individual, you know, there are individuals with autism who have gained skills in verbalization, for example, who have been in their teens, in their 20s, in their 40s, and it is never too late to start biomedical intervention for an individual with autism.
I completely agree with that, by the way.
That's
absolutely
great.
But if we can, you know, we want to try to catch them young.
Of course.
Now, let's talk about, do you guys know about the rapid prompting method, Dr.
Mm-hmm.
Barton?
Mm-hmm.
And can you talk to the audience about what that is and how effective you think it is?
Well, that's another variant of a behavioral method. And I should say, you know, applied behavior analysis is a very broad term today. We didn't used to think of it that way. That includes things like pivotal response training and the rapid prompting method, all of which are strategies to help kids focus their attention on the kinds of behaviors they need to be learning and to use them quickly and continuously and consistently in natural environments. Sometimes you have to start them by themselves. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I just want to piggyback on what Terry was saying about how it's not too late if the child is 10 or 20 or 40, because last night in A Mother's Courage, the mother who actually, that the documentary is about, she's from Iceland, her son was 10, and she took him at 10 years old to try to learn from this rapid prompting method. And come to find out, you know, that there was this whole human being inside that she had no idea about. I think that's one of the biggest myths is that, and I'm sure I'm going to ask Aisha again about this, our perspective as a person who doesn't have autism, we're looking, you know, at the person with autism and thinking they don't know anything, they're not aware, but they are aware in many cases and they can see what's going on and they are absorbing information, but how they process it and put it back out to the world is different than us. Aisha, do you feel that people thought maybe you were stupid or didn't know what you were doing when you were younger?
Yes, plenty of people thought that, some even called me retarded.
Mm. Well, Dr. Barton, you can speak to that. I mean, in my research, a lot of parents had their children diagnosed with mental retardation and not autism.
Yes, I think that that used to happen more often than it does now. I think one of the reasons for the increased incidence prevalence that we're seeing in autism spectrum disorders is that we are more accurately diagnosing kids that we would have once thought of as mentally retarded or intellectually disabled. Now we recognize that, in fact, they have an autism spectrum disorder.
Dr. Barton, I'm sorry. I beg to differ. The Mind Institute at the UC Davis in California ruled out things like demographic shift and change in diagnostic substitution. And California has been the state with the best record keeping, and they only were counting full syndrome autism. So I think that those have been ruled out.
I don't think so. I think there's, you know, there's always dispute about this, but I think the most recent discussion of the reasons for the increase in prevalence, we certainly can't rule out a real increase in the biomedical, disorder. But our diagnostic system changed dramatically in 1994, and that's when the incidence really started increasing. So, you know, we'll continue to debate this, and I don't mean to suggest that there's no real increase, but there's probably a good portion of the huge increase that we have seen is related to changes in the diagnostic system. And in California, you know, there's been some debate about the shift from the intellectually disabled population to the autism population, but I think there's data from really around the world that suggests that diagnosis contributes to this.
Well, I want to, Terry, let me just interrupt. We have only a couple minutes left. I want to bring up the issue that in the 1700s, people who had children with autism, which they realize now was probably autism, were called fairy changelings. And so it's not something new that's been happening to the humans, that autism has been around for hundreds of years. Are any of you familiar with that issue, historical perspective? I guess, Dr. Barton, are you familiar with studies on autism as far back as 1700s?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we didn't have this language, but we certainly have clinical descriptions in the literature of children whom we would now call autistic. Prior to 1943, we called these children psychotic. We now understand that that's completely incorrect. Mm. But, you know, our thinking evolves over time.
But not with desperately ill children. The CDC says that one child in 110 has an autism spectrum disorder, and it's much higher for boys. This is an epidemic, and it is a real and true epidemic. We didn't have an epidemic of gastroenterological problems before. People would have noticed this many children who couldn't speak. You were speaking earlier about neurodiversity, Joy. There is a difference between a person who is able to express themselves and speak as well as Mr. Niemann, and a child who is desperately physiologically ill with gastrointestinal pathology, who cannot talk or keep themselves safe or independent.
I agree with you, Terry, and that's why I wanted to have you on the show, Terry, and also Camille. Let's mention your website, Terry, which is autism1.org, correct?
Yes, www.autism1.org. That's correct.
And Camille, your web address, can you tell us your web address?
It's thecolorofautismfoundation.org.
And Camille, you have an event coming up soon, don't you?
Yes, I do. And it goes to speak to something we were speaking about earlier. A lot of people don't realize that many parents of special needs children are either unemployed or underemployed. So we put together a Parents Enabled Fair so the parents can come out in the greater Atlanta area and meet with, you know, healthcare professionals as well as some holistic professionals, and we're going to have job opportunities. And we're trying to get parents in a better place so they can care
What date is your event, and where is it located? We have 2 minutes left. Tell us quickly
April
about that.
April 17th, Crown Plaza in Atlanta. And the information is on my website, and that's thecolorofautism.org.
And Joy,
yes.
If there are people who are facing challenges economically who feel that they want to help their child heal, but they can't afford the price of registration, the Autism One Conference offers registration scholarships.
That's excellent. And Aisha, just closing, we have 1 minute left. What would you tell people who are dealing with Asperger's and autism? What is your couple words of hope for them?
Well, I say to all of them, and I mean this, never give up. Don't care about what other people think of you as an individual. Just strive for perfection, because even with someone with autism could be somebody in life that you thought that was impossible.
I want to thank all of you this morning, Dr. Barton, Camille, Terry, Aisha, all of you for coming on this morning. And I want to tell all the listeners out there, please, please, if you have a friend or a family member or you just know someone, a coworker, please have them listen to the podcast and so they can learn more about autism and the resources that are available to them. I'll be posting links on my website. You can also follow me on twitter.com/JoyKeys. You can become a fan of Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys on Facebook. And for those of you who are into your little iPod, you can download the podcast from iTunes. Again, thank you, Dr. Barton, Camille, Terry, and Aisha for coming on this morning. I really appreciate you sharing all of your knowledge. Have a wonderful Saturday.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
In 1977, an 8-year-old boy picked up the game of golf from his father. The odds of that same boy winning the U.S. Open twice, 1 in 1.2 billion. The odds of him having a child diagnosed with autism? 1 in 110. Ernie Else encourages you to learn the signs of autism at autismspeaks.org. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council.